morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming to our conversation on immigration. So a couple of weeks ago, when we were preparing to come here, Diane asked the teaching faculty, hey, should we do a session, a conversation about immigration? And many of us said yes. So we wanted to convene a conversation. And I think what we're each going to do is talk for just a couple of minutes about our interactions from our various disciplines thinking about immigration, and then we'll open it up for a larger conversation. I'll go first.
All but one of the refugee resettlement organizations in the U.S. are affiliated with faith-based organizations. Why is that? So let's talk to some of them about their concerns in this moment. And then the other bit of feedback around the session's story was, why are you engaging him on those terms? Like, why are you even, well, there's a sort of an ongoing debate of like whether we should let people say things on the air. I think we should let people say things on the air and then talk about what they mean and what they do. So that is just a little bit about how I have been engaging this question of immigration in my work. Because I'm the religion editor, I'm engaging it as at the what are people of faith doing and saying, and how are they acting and behaving around immigration issues of turning away refugees. Because of my role as a journalist, like in my daily life, I would like my personal views about these things to be represented in these pieces, but it is also part of my job and my responsibility to make sure that other views are well represented in those pieces as well. I think that's actually the concern that from the feedback that we get, is that people are happy to have their view represented in a piece. They are not happy to have other people's views represented in a piece. If I was just telling people what I think, I would write for an op-ed page. I wouldn't work for the front page, basically, which is everything, all things considered, just the front page. Yeah. So those are some ways that I've been thinking about it. And when we get to the conversation part with you, if you have questions about how we approach it, we do much more immigration coverage than just that, but that's the part that I'm responsible for. So let me, who would like to comment?
Hi. Jeff Carlisle. I've been playing the viola mostly, but I teach eighth grade science in Austin, Texas, at a charter school called KIPP, which has a national network across the country dedicated to providing kids from underserved communities the right to education opportunity. About half of the students that I teach happen to be undocumented or their family is. And so immigration is something that is like core to our daily experience at school. My kids are amazing though, because they come for an extended school day. They go to school 2 hours longer than all the other kids in town. Extended school year. They take home boatloads of homework on every single break. So they're the hardest working students in Austin. And so I kind of love when people make negative statements about the work ethic of immigrants, particularly Mexicans. That my students are direct evidence of that not being true. Unfortunately, they are living under a constant barrage of attack from many levels of government. So we in Austin elected a sheriff who was going to enact sanctuary city policies in Austin. Now, sanctuary cities aren't a legal term, but what it essentially means is, like, if you get stopped by the police, they won't ask you about your immigration status, which would be racial profiling. If you are detained by the police, they won't turn you over to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, unless it's a violent crime. Because what they find is the more participation they do with ICE or asking about immigration, the less likely these people are willing to call the police. So then they're not safe. And partnering with communities is like one of the most important parts of policing. And so at the same time what was happening is that Texas was enacting a bill to ban any sanctuary city policies as a direct result of the choices that Austin is doing, because we also happen to be the state capital. So there's oftentimes a push and pull going between the two groups. And then what happened in January of 2017 was a coordinated attack happened from the Justice Department, where they sent in about 400 ICE agents to Austin secretly. And then it started getting spread on social media that this was happening. And so our parents got pretty freaked out and were calling the school saying, there are reports of like ICE agents coming. And then it showed up on the news where families were getting detained in grocery stores, and they're going through neighborhoods and asking, do you know where this person is? And so we, as teachers, decided we were going to ride the bus with kids to go home with them, just to make sure like somebody was there to pick them up. And it's, I get pretty frustrated because our kids are amazing and our families are amazing. And so as a result of all this, in February, there was a, I think it was February, national Day Without Immigrants. And like only 20% of our kids showed up to school on that day. About 80% of them and their families chose to walk out of their jobs and school. And if there's one thing I've learned about the experience of immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants, they follow the rules to a T because they're so scared about what might happen if they draw attention to themselves. And to see them stand up and make that statement was incredible. And it actually was quoted in the New York Times. And so while I'm really upset to hear the way that people talk about my students who don't know them, I'm glad to see that they're able to stand up for themselves and get the appropriate amount of attention that they deserve.
They were brave.
Yeah. They should be here.
John Barty is state senator, so I'm probably the political part of the panel. And I first want to say that the way we're treating immigrants is, to a certain extent, not unusual. We've done that throughout American history. German immigrants picked on Italians or Poles or whoever was coming later. Later waves were always given worse treatment than others. And there is always a certain segment of the population that very much hateful towards them. Maybe all of us have an instinct in us to be unwelcoming, and so maybe all of us have a part of it. And I think what's changed right now is that the nation's spokesperson, President of the United States, is taking the most hateful of those stands and pushing that as our public image to the world and to immigrants and everybody else. It's kind of as if we elected David Duke and George Wallace in previous generations and said, you're going to be the one speaking for us as a nation. And so that, to me, is really a big part of what's happened. I think the last week's Time magazine cover, most of you may have seen it, maybe not, is a just plain red cover with the picture of the little immigrant girl who was crying, the iconic image that made it around the nation of a little 2 or 3 year old immigrant girl who's crying and tears looking up as they're searching her mother. And she's looking up in this red cover, and President Trump is looking down at her with kind of a glare. And the only words in the caption are, "Welcome to America." And it summarizes, you know, it's obviously it's not a welcome. It's a, we don't want you here. We want to stay as far away from you as possible. It's interesting. It's ironic to me, as a public official who represents lots of people, most of whom I think are outraged at the family separation, outraged at people being locked up for months. Most people are outraged with our nation's policies, and many people are egging on those policies and happy to see them happen. What's ironic about that is we're a nation that's at least 99% immigrants or descendants of immigrants. And we are treating immigrants, people like us, only newer, as if they're less valued, less human. We treat them as, even put a word, illegal on people. So we treat them in a very painfully awful way. Something that to me is, I mean, when you think about the fact that likely everybody in this room, maybe an exception or two, are descendants of immigrants, you know, nobody invited us here. We just came, and we're basically, nobody invited us. Matter of fact, when we got here, most of us, our ancestors, were given, instead of, well, we'll let you do this if we see this and if this, they were giving them free land in the Homestead Act and giving them a chance to get started in life. And the schools to give them an education, give them better hope. And for farmers, they had exchange extension services and so on to help them farm. We gave a helping hand to people who were here. But now we're saying, even though we're those folks who came uninvited and just decided, well, we're squatters on somebody else's land, but we decided we own the place and we don't want anyone else here. And I think the one thing when there was discussion, and I don't know, maybe it was in Jason's session earlier about, these are not who we are as a people. Well, some people, well, hey, we've always been that way. Well, I don't think that's who we are as a people. It's not the better angels of our nature. It's not the best of us. But I think our national values are the Emma Lazarus poem in the Statue of Liberty, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free. And it even talks about the wretched, the tempest tossed. Wretched is kind of the word that Trump would say, hey, they're sending us their refuse, their garbage, their worst of their criminal element. This Emma Lazarus poem is saying basically they're sending us this, and people who are, I think, not meaning wretched in the sense that they're criminal or anything, but wretched and people who have been tempest tossed, people who have been suffering, and we're going to lift our lamp up to them and welcome them in. And I think that's who we are as a nation, and that's what Independence Day is a good day to remember that. But it's a horrific appeal. Again, all of us have better and worse instincts in us, and clearly now we as a nation are promoting, or at least our leader is promoting, those hateful instincts in us, which is, again, as I said, highly ironic given the fact that he and we and almost all of us are ourselves descendants of immigrants.
I'm Peter Dothan. I approach this as a Christian ethicist. That's my training. And I think the big question I have been asking and trying to work through with others is, how do you have a conversation about immigration? I ask that in part because it's so emotionally fraught. It brings up our hopefully better angels, but it also brings up, I think, our tribal instincts, our desire to sort of other the other, which creates a lot of inability to find the commonalities. And I think that's where I struggle personally, but I also struggle with others. And some of the resources I rely on then obviously come from the Christian tradition. And one of the big ones, obviously, is that all of us are created in the image of God. And I think that's always a challenge, because on the one hand, certainly that young lady, she 3 from Honduras, I think, on the Time Cover, a child of God, but so is Trump. So are the voters that supported Trump, including some in my family. Folks who in some ways have experienced the problematic features of a global economy in a way that I haven't. You know, I'm in a position of sort of privilege in that sense. Who see their way of life withering away. Fear. How do you find and unite with others their humanity, that image of God that we all share? I think that's one key piece that I think is really challenging for all of us, and especially a place like Holden, where the tendency is to, we're much probably more in common than we are divided on this issue. So how do we not other the other in this kind of conversation? That's one piece. Another piece I bring up, and this comes from Theology of the Cross, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, and particularly Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who really wanted to remind and call Christians to say that one's allegiance to the world and one's nation is not one's true allegiance. It's a penultimate concern. We're called by God to love our neighbors, to be good citizens. And that's part of the messiness of our lives. But the higher calling is to love God. and relate to that penultimate concern, our family, our nation state, our nation's laws, through our relationship to God, which is rooted in love. Love of the neighbor, mutual concern, which sort of relativizes but makes us responsible for how we act as citizens in the world. The need then to critique our nation's laws at the same time to sort of recognize the importance of them. That's that tension, I think, that is part of the theology of the cross. And the third piece, and both Jeff and John have brought this up, but you know, we come from a tradition that tells stories. And one huge part of our storied and imaginative and collective consciousness as Christians is stories of immigration and movement, of exodus, of being on the outside, being on the margins. And I think not only do we have scriptural tradition that brings that up, like John was saying, you know, I'm not native.
Yeah.
Name like Peter Joseph. I'm not native. Natives have, unfortunately, my ancestors pushed them off their land. Those are some of the resources that shape how I think about how do we have this conversation without othering the other.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Diane Jacobson. I come to you as a biblical scholar, but I come to you also. My daughter-in-law and one of my sons are immigrants. My daughter-in-law's from Korea. I have a Tanzanian son, and they are now American citizens. But if they had not become American citizens about 5 years ago, I have no idea where they'd be right now, and that's terrifying. Also, one other little personal thing, which is, I serve on the board of Augsburg University, and this very day, a tenured professor from Augsburg is being deported.
No.
Because you know, he's... This very day, he has to leave, go back home in danger. It's terrifying. So I've been part of the community surrounding him, and so I'm thinking about that today. When I think about the issue of immigration, the book that most speaks to me in scripture is the Book of Ruth. David Vasquez Levy, my maiden name is Levy, so we think we were kind of twins separated at birth, though he's an immigrant from Guatemala. He and I wrote a book for the Book of Faith thing on Ruth, and it's primarily about Ruth through the eyes of immigration. And I think of this also as a book that's struggling with the issues of law, as we are as Americans too. And there are two sets of laws that are just ringing through the Book of Ruth. One law that says, those Moabites are the people that didn't greet you and didn't let you go through when you were trying to come after the Exodus. Never allow a Moabite to set foot at the temple. Never marry a Moabite. Never treat them well. Because they treated you so miserably. You know, it's a little like our reaction after 9/11, you know? And it's written in the law. And then there are all the laws about welcoming the stranger, and you are strangers yourself, and let the widow and the orphan and the stranger glean from the land, and all of those. And the Book of Ruth is about the tension in the community between those two sets of laws. Are we going to be the people who obey this law? Or are we going to be the people who obey that law? And Boaz, one of the leaders of the community, has to help the community decide which one. Is Ruth, this Moabite, a member of the family or not? Can she be considered a member of the family? And had Boaz and the community decided differently, we would have no David, and we would have no Jesus. It depended on the community listening to that other part of the law and obeying that other part of the law. So when I think of us as biblical people struggling with this issue of immigration, I think of us inside the Book of Ruth, struggling about how we are going to think about the strangers in our midst and the immigrants, even from nations with whom we have a questionable history.
One question for maybe you and Petter, and then I want to hear what you have to say. When you hear elected and appointed officials quoting either the, take care of the widow and follow the law, how did you, in your mind, right, are you glad that the Bible is being talked about in public? I find it disturbing. Like, I never thought that my religion classes from the unnamed college in the upper Midwest would come in handy this way. How do you think about it?
Well, I get a little frustrated, I have to say, not with NPR. But, right now, religion coverage tends to think the only Christians in the country are Franklin. And
Franklin Graham.
The only people who get press are the conservative religious people. And one of my examples is in the last election, no one would have known that Hillary Clinton was a devout Methodist, whose favorite book was Proverbs, I might add. How do we, as part of a different kind of Protestant religious organization, or Jewish, or Muslim, or whatever, become the voice? Why is it always radical Muslims instead of other Muslims? So I'm always wondering why we always put these adjectives in front of these things.
Let me just quickly say, I think that you are right. I've been to many religion symposia in the last couple of years, religion and news symposia, where it keeps coming up that why do evangelicals get all of the airtime or all of the ink? Mm-hmm. And when we did analysis of our coverage, it was about a quarter of our coverage was on evangelicals, which is pretty close to the population, but the way over-covered groups then would be Muslims, which are only 1% of the population, but we spend a lot of time covering them. Catholics, who are a quarter of the population, get very little press coverage. So sometimes the news intervenes and you can't just do if Franklin Graham is saying inflammatory things and has a big swath of the electorate listening to him and enough of the electorate to swing elections, then you have to pay attention to it. So that's, I'm not trying to excuse why we pay attention to it, I'm just going to explain.
I think the way I would answer the question is, the Bible is a disturbing book.
Yes.
And it's a book, as soon as you go, the Bible says, you can always find something that is its counter or its opposite.
Oh, sure you can.
And for you to recognize, and for someone to use it as this sort of, I know what the Bible says, I think says more about the person than it does about the Bible. And because it's disturbing and dangerous, it requires a lot of us as readers to recognize that in many ways, it's a journey into a story, and the story has twists and turns, and it has opposing voices who are having debates about what God is and what Jesus is. I mean, that's true even in the four Gospels. And I think what that requires us is caution and conversation and to pay attention to the context and to recognize that if there is sort of a thread holding everything together, it is sort of the story of love and the story of concern and the story of responsibility to enact and live and embody that love with each other. And to say the Bible then says this often misses that thread and ignores it. Because frankly, it's really easy to say the Bible says this.
Because it says everything.
it's a lot harder to wrestle and to really find the dignity, that image of God that we all share, that I think is also in the threads that you get in that text.
Right, yeah.
Well, we would like to hear your questions about how we approach this. Maybe if you were going to make a statement and not a question, I would just ask that you make it fairly brief so that as many people as possible can
speak. Can I say a few things? I have a lot to say, but I can say a few things. Immigration is a very touchy subject for a lot of people. All right, and a few examples. For example, in the early 1900s, we have a big wave of Irish who built the New York subways. The big wave of Cubans who have taken over the top politics of Florida. So the way I look at it when I was a kid, I had somebody next to me was a DP. They called them a displaced person at the time. But he learned English very fast, because it was the only language he had to learn, English, whatever his language was, I don't know, somewhere from Europe. So I think you should have people come here, but they should not be in enclaves just of their own, so they only operate in their own areas that they're familiar with. They should be learn English as soon as possible and be part of the whole situation of that have in America. So that's my feeling.
When I was a kid in Minnesota, which is not too long ago, there were still enclaves from different places. You know, we thought of Silver Lake, well, that's a Bohemian town, and this town over here, that's the way people, I mean, you don't go somewhere as a group and just disperse out. You want something familiar so you get your feet on the ground. So I understand what you're saying, but I don't think it's realistic. I think every group that has come, no matter where from, they have their own community for safety and eventually they disperse out. But you aren't going to be able to say, yeah, you come, but you have to live there, and you've got to live three states away. That's not the way human beings are.
I think we would all do well to research a bit of our own family immigration history and learn about who our grandfathers and great-grandfathers were. There are better resources today than ever to do that. I was recently doing that with my great-grandfather, Saverio Aiello from southern Italy, and I didn't know that he actually received like this order of merit from the country of Italy because he helped other immigrants after him get citizenship in the United States. And yet I also learned that he never really learned English and spoke English only at home. My grandfather was bilingual. My father only speaks English. So it can happen. It just happens over generations. And I don't know that it's fair to ask a 90-year-old great-great-grandmother who immigrated from Italy to ever learn English. So.
We have friends in Germany, lifelong friends, and I was really eager when I was soon to be reunited with them what their opinion was on Angela Merkel's policy and receiving a million refugees, and I wondered what they would think of that. I was eager to talk. Here's what, in a very brief form, we need young people. Our society is getting old. We can't afford to support all these old people in our Social Security system. We need young workers. We need young blood. We're glad to have them. That's okay, that's not the whole German society, but that was happened to be our friends. Is there a voice like that in the U.S. saying that? Because it seems like we need to lift up what's good about people who might be here, even if they might be here illegally.
I'll say that there are some groups who, agricultural groups in Washington State and California, so they need migrant workers. They're desperate. If you shut the door on them, they're scared of that. The chambers of commerce in a lot of states are very, very much, but it's interesting because they're kind of quiet because sometimes their political allies are the ones who are preaching the hatred. Get rid of them, lock the wall, lock the gates, and keep them out. And they're kind of torn because I don't want to be attacking the people who I'm allied with, but we need these immigrants. So yes, I think there is, there's a lot of mixed feelings in a lot of people, but the economy needs them.
Yeah.
We have shortages of workers in many places, and as like big agricultural farmers are saying is, we can't get anybody here who will do the work, so we need the immigrants. So there is some of that, but there's also, again, some of the times the people they're allied with in public debate and civic discourse and elected officials and so on are bashing immigrants because they no appeals to another different part of the segment of the population. Mm. So they've been, relatively speaking, quiet in the public debate about it. Mm.
I wonder if I can offset that just a little bit. I agree with you completely. And when unemployment was high, people who were unemployed weren't lining up to pick apples. And the counter just a little bit, in a class I taught this last term, I had a student from Chumawa Indian School, one of the remaining Indian boarding schools, come and speak with my class of undergraduates in Oregon. And she's a senior, and someone in my class asked what she was planning to do, expecting the answer to be to go back to the reservation. And the answer was, I'm going to become a neurosurgeon, then I'm going back to the reservation. Mm-hmm. And there was this, there was shock because this was an Indian child, and Indian children go certain directions, and you know, unconsciously, but this idea that she was aspiring to be a neurosurgeon was a shock. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to, and I know you're not, to say this is the role our immigrants will play.
Well, I absolutely was not suggesting that. I'm just saying that some of the people who are very silent about immigration, who really don't want it to end, include a lot of those folks who hire migrant workers.
One interesting question for me is, part of the frame of the conversation about immigration seems to me to be, there is only so much, and if other people get some, I will either have only what I have now or less. And another part of the conversation is, we don't like brown people. And I think that those two are way more overlapping than people want to believe, because the genteel way to talk about it is unemployment. A less genteel way to talk about it is, I don't like that there are brown people in my grocery store now. And I think that we sometimes try to forgive that part of it by focusing, especially in the way we report on it, focusing on the more genteel form of discrimination rather than a much more bald-faced
one. I serve a congregation in Seattle, in a progressive neighborhood, almost entirely white congregation in a very white part of the city. And I think the question that I keep asking and wanting to understand better, and I'd love to hear if there's a quick answer from each of you. What is the thing that a local congregation can do that will make the most difference?
I've got one. My mom actually, in her home congregation, has started this organization called Backpack Buddies. And so they partner with local schools where there are students who are food insecure. And then they meet with teachers to identify who those kids are, meet with the parents to get their permission for this. And then when the kids are out at recess, they stuff their backpacks with food for the weekend and things like that, or toiletries. And so for congregations to sponsor schools where kids don't have these kinds of resources, because I have kids who come to school all week long wearing the exact same set of clothes. And we have things like toothbrushes and stuff because they need it when they come, because they don't have access to a lot of these things. And a congregation like yours, I'm sure, would be able to do something really important for those kids.
So we have the Ballard Food Bank a few blocks from our congregation, and we have a very large backpack program there, working with the Seattle schools that are working on that. And my son's church, he's a minister in Yakima, they started up their own local program like that to we have some of those things going on, and that is a good idea to work with the Zoos Project.
The other thing I add to that, again, from the political realm of it, is to be vocal and to speak out, whether in social media posting, letters to the editor, speaking out. I think in Minneapolis, since I left there, there was a huge rally on immigration things. I think the church has it. Franklin Graham, I mean, obviously is not a biblical scholar. And to say the least, I had not heard what Jason just said about him saying that earlier, but I think the very fact that churches have been very, very active in immigration over the decades, over the centuries, they understand their call to serve the foreigner, the stranger, and so on. So I think the more you're vocal, the more it helps not just the media, but the public at large understand, the politicians therefore understand that it's not all. We hate those immigrants, we've got to put up border walls.
In Bend, Oregon, our church nativity at the south end of Bend has formed with eight other churches in Bend, formed what was originally called the sanctuary group. And when we found that was a legal term, we went to Neighbor Love. The Bend has about six committees of different functions, from rapid response to helping them, but we're also involved with a local Latino community and the community leader, Latino community leaders. We have 12,000 undocumented in Central Oregon, and I don't know what the outcome will be of all that activity, but these nine churches are involved in being in direct support to that community, and I don't know what all the committees are doing. I only know about mine, so.
I would also say Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. Yes.
So,
and all of, I mean, the Lutheran tradition has this wonderful social.
I have an odd Lutheran Immigration Refugee Service story. I have always given, even when I had very little money, at least a little bit of money to Lutheran Immigration Refugee Services. And when we started quoting them in stories, I had to stop giving to them because I can't give money to the organizations I report on. Luckily, you can launder that money through your congregation.
Tell stories.
Yeah.
You know, tell biblical stories, but tell the truth. I mean, I think what John was saying about this is also our history. We were talking about that in Germany. Germany has learned to tell the truth about its history. America has to learn to tell the truth about its history.
The emphasis appears to be this moment right now. And when these immigrant families come in, maybe grandma doesn't speak it, her children will value, they're the ones that brought the family to America. They will see to it that their children, their grandchildren, will excel in everything imaginable. And I'm thinking now when Vietnam fell and a bunch of people came, our national speller was a Vietnamese immigrant. English was not her first language. So, you know, to say nothing of supporting old people with Social Security and all that, the people that are coming on the long term will excel and contribute.
Sure.
Getting back to your question about what can you do, I sort of put things as a person who covers groups, I think that I would sort of summarize what I'm hearing from the panel up here and from many of you is direct activity in some way that helps people, political activity that is you know, writing, talking to your representative officials, but also being visible. I have noticed around immigration a lot of clergy visibility in Los Angeles where I live, and even though I don't cover Los Angeles, I just happen to be based there. You know, the LA Times had a huge front page picture of a bunch of clergy being arrested after, I believe it was the Supreme Court upheld the I heard it from the Muslim ban. And, you know, seeing a couple dozen clergy in their albs and stoles being arrested in front of the ICE office is a visible act that elevated that to the attention of probably a lot of people who thought there's only one kind of person of faith in America, because some of them are getting perhaps undeserved attention, or I don't think it's undeserved. I think it is attention because they're doing something. But you have to be visible in what you do so that people know there are countervailing voices of people of faith.
So
I'm not saying get arrested, I'm just saying get arrested. You know, for instance, like in my, this is not about immigration, but like in my town, like Fred Phelps shows up to protest at Santa Monica High School periodically, and about 24 clergy from my town show up in their alls to just usher students into school. And so that is a visible thing that they do. It takes them about half an hour once a month when he shows up. It's a very visible public witness.
So I guess if I could just follow up, I can see that as positive in having a positive impact in terms of our congregation, maybe the Lutheran circles, progressive churches, people's understandings of Christian attitudes. Do you think it has any kind of an impact on the largest conversation?
I think that when a clergy person writes an op-ed piece in the Seattle Times, it probably does have something. If you were to go on to a local radio or TV show and talk in your collar, talking from, as a person of faith from that perspective, that can have a huge effect. I know, news channels are on all day long around my office. I don't think it's just because I edit religion, but I notice the people wearing their liturgical, or not liturgical, their clergy garb on TV, and I think so do a lot of other people. So I would try it. Oh, I'm sorry, back in the back.
In the Portland area, we have a group called Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice, and it's people from all faiths, and we're coming together as a cohort to try and figure out how we can either provide sanctuary, provide aid, and provide accompaniment for people. We can't go in and just say, I'm going to fix this for you. And we have to acknowledge at the church that I attend that we are a mostly white church in a mostly white neighborhood, and we cannot expect those people whom we wish to help to gravitate to us, because they would not be comfortable coming in there. They would be nervous coming in there, actually, whether they need to be or not. So we have to look for ways where we can accompany. Maybe we are not equipped to provide sanctuary of that if something would arise where that would be necessary, but we can accompany a church in the inner city that could. We can accompany a congregation or a group of people. We have to be able to go to them. We can't just sit there and say, hey, we're good people. You know, we would love to, you know, provide you with some help. Come to us, because they are not comfortable with us. They have too much to fear to be comfortable in that situation. So when our congregations look at that, we need to look at working with other faiths and in other neighborhoods.
Over here.
Well, I was listening to Rachel Maddow's show the other night, and this was a practical thing that was done. There was a mother in Texas who was detained, and her children were in New York City, three of them, very young children. And she couldn't get out because she didn't have the money to pay whatever needed to be paid to the legal system. People volunteered, collected that money. Then the problem was to get her to her children. She was afraid to fly because she didn't have identification. So they set up a car relay from Texas to a few hundred miles to a few hundred miles and got her back. And the children were in foster care, so she couldn't see them right away, but on TV, the next day, she would be seeing her three children again. So that was, and that could be used, congregations could do things like that, and it's very, very visible. And it actually does some good, yeah.
For the biblical scholars, it seems like what you're arguing for is a complex reading, or at least a reading of the Bible that requires some capacity of curiosity and some sort of reading that would require more lenses than just a single lens. And there seems to be on on certain sides of the political spectrum a disdain for a complex unity, or not, maybe not disdain, but that a complex reading is a challenge to faith. Right? And so I wonder, in your experience as teachers, what does it mean to disrupt that disdain, or what does it mean to spark that curiosity for a reading that will press us into the complex reading?
It's a great question, thank you. And I have to say, I think it's larger that wanting a simple answer, I think is beyond just how you read the Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, let's not get complicated. This is all very straightforward, and we want someone to solve us. You know, we want a slogan way of living in the world. Is a larger problem than just scripture. It's how do you say that truth is in community, is in conversation? And for myself, I like putting a story in front of people and inviting them in. And then we do it together. And it's the only way I know that works. I remember doing a little thing on the Lydia story, which is 4 verses. And we spent about an hour and a half. And this young man in the back room said, "I've never read scripture before." He said, "That was really, really fun, interesting." I'm thinking, how do I know the whole Bible? And it was like, don't worry about it. One step at a time is just fine. Just start.
I teach a lot of undergrads, obviously, single ones. About a third of them are unchurched or have no experience with the Bible. But a third think they know what the Bible says. And a third probably have some experience or are completely apathetic towards the Bible.
That leaves nobody who's just interested and engaged.
I think there's a natural tendency once you know something to move on. And I think when you challenge people to recognize that you know that you don't know it, that you, I use Diane's words, you invite them into this kind of story, this journey, and that you have to wrestle with it and you have to pay attention to it. So it's less about knowing and more about being. Yeah. I think that's what I hope. I mean, that's what Christianity is. Christianity is not a doctrine. It's a way of inhabiting the world. And you make mistakes, and you have to think about the best. We're thinking right now together about how do we respond to this issue as Christians, and there are no easy answers.
As the non-biblical scholar and political one, I'll give the political soundbite type response. The person who wants the simple answer might be, when Christ tells us how to simplify all the law into a couple sentences, I mean, love your God and love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, that's the shorthand way of doing it if you need a soundbite. And I mean, if there are people who only want that, then that's a good way to summarize it.
Probably have time for 2 more.
I wanted to just bring up the subject of detention centers, which I think there's a whole political agenda on top of where are we going to put these people. And there, many of them are for-profit private institutions.
Yes.
And there is a mandate in Congress that not just that there must be a certain number of beds available, but a certain number of beds must be filled. So once somebody gets there, they can't get out until somebody else comes to take their place. And I am concerned that all the publicity that has been created over this most recent, I don't know what's happening now because we don't have the news available in the same way, but is just going to be an excuse to build more detention centers.
I mean, I think that it would be a very good idea for people to pay attention to what I often refer to as the immigration industrial complex, in the same way that like after 9/11 we had this security industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, millions of jobs were created around making you take your shoes off in for what I refer to as security theater. But I think that we would all do well to be aware of who's getting rich off of this. Some of the estimates have said that it's almost $1,000 a night to keep a person in one of these detention centers, which is way more than it costs to stay in a hotel, or even good hotels. So.
And then the flip side of that is, I'm from New York City, and we're able to visit people in the detention center in Elizabeth, New Jersey, which is right by Newark Airport. But people who have people that can visit them do better in their immigration hearings, and certainly partnering with interfaith organizations. And I happen to be the president of the board of Seafarers International House, and we have made rooms available when the people get out of detention, if their asylum has been granted, to help them, in similar to how what LRS does in resettling the refugees, and like for the first several weeks, get them a subway pass and figure out where to go grocery shopping, and just help them get their papers in order. And if there are things people can do, you know, there's other millions of, well, I mean millions, how many detention centers all over the country, but to try to actually make some contact.
Okay, one more here.
We're talking about direct action and storytelling. There's another option for entering into the reality, which is how we change. Someone told me once, so not until I feel the pain of somebody else do I get active to work to get rid of my own pain about that. One of the things I do is lead delegations to the Texas-Mexico border, El Paso and Juarez, to enter into that reality and hear the stories from people who have crossed or who have crossed and have had to go back, and hear the stories of people who have experienced what's happening in their countries. A lot of them, of course, from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, who share and show the scars of the bullet wounds in their body. Mm-hmm. And that changes our lives. Mm-hmm. And they come home wondering how, now that they know what they know, how do they become active and work to get rid of that pain. Wallingford United Methodist Church in Seattle, they have, I took a group from that congregation, and they now meet people when they come out of detention in Tacoma, I think it is.
Yeah.
They got active. They had to work to make that pain go away that they now felt. And so I offer that, and didn't occur to me till now that maybe I should set up a little interest group for people who want to learn more about how to do that. And I accompany them to the border, and we spend a week. So it's another option to get involved and to take that deeper. Take your desire to learn or to know more or to get active another step deeper.
I want to thank you, and I want to thank so many people in this room who have these unbelievable, I mean, we're sitting up here on the panel. Probably everybody in this room could sit on the panel because there's so much wisdom here. And to invite us, especially on this day, to share these conversations with each other and learn from each other just precisely the kinds of things you're teaching and ask each other questions about what you do, that's probably the best way that this panel is going to have an effect, is for you all to talk to each other as well as just listen to us.
So thank you all for coming.